It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power.
And now, here's Al Gore's Midnight Massage Man, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. Our special guest today is James Dellingpole. He is a writer for Human Events, The Times of London, The Spectator, and The Daily Telegraph. He is also the author of Welcome to Obamaland and the recently released 365 Ways to Drive a Liberal Crazy. James, welcome to the show.
Mark, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Anybody who doesn't believe in global warming is automatically a friend of mine.
Yes, so I must admit, there are quite a few Al Gore jokes in my book.
I loved every one of them, but I want to get back to the title of the book, 365 Ways to Drive a Liberal Crazy. Now, Michael Savage wrote a book, and by the way, he won't be visiting you anytime soon, entitled Liberalism is a Mental Disorder, and you made a similar remark on page 11 of your book. Given the fact that most liberals are already crazy, I mean, can we do any more damage there?
Well, it's certainly true that liberalism is a kind of psychopathology, a mental affliction, and there is no way that we are going to convert them through reason. In some ways, it is an act of cruelty tormenting liberals. It is tormenting the afflicted. But on the other hand, you think about all the misery they inflict on us, you know, the way they make out that we're bad people, that we don't care about the poor, that we don't care about the needy, we don't care about the disabled, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's about time we had a bit of payback.
Well, I agree. I think it's time we stop worrying about being labeled racist, homophobes, Islamophobes, and just say what's on our mind. And you've certainly done that. I say with great confidence that you're not an author who worries about being labeled politically incorrect.
Yeah, well, you know what? I see what this springs from, Mark. I mean, to be serious for a moment, I've got lots of gay friends. I've got black friends. I've got Muslim friends. And I kind of feel that this qualifies me not to give a damn about political correctness. You know, I know I'm not a bad person. I know that my conservatism springs essentially from a view that this is the best, fairest, happiest way for humankind. And that the problem is liberalism, which throughout history in its various manifestations, be it communism, Stalinism, socialism, eco-fascism, Nazism, because of course Hitler was a left-winger, he was a national socialist, whatever form it's taken, liberalism has led to disaster, misery, poverty, etc. Whereas conservatism has brought happiness, fruitfulness, and liberty.
Well, you know, I think it's great in your book that you point out that things like Black History Month are almost kind of a racist comment in and of themselves, as if black people need us to point out all the wonderful things that they've done.
Of course it's racist. It is absolutely racist to have a special month for people on the basis of their skin color. What's that supposed to send about the world? You know, I like to think that if a black kid came to England and started learning, you know, history in his classes, he could feel as proud of the events, of the achievements of our medieval kings, say, as a white person. I don't feel that you should be isolated. In the same way, I don't think that you know, white kids have any problems learning about, say, ancient Egypt. You know, just because they were Egyptian, just because they didn't have white skin, doesn't put them off limits. You know, it's reductivist. And I think that it's very good to call liberals on this. You know, there's one entry in the book where I point out that although President Obama is America's allegedly first black president, he is also America's 44th white president. Because isn't it kind of sexist overlooking his mom's genetic input? You know, she was a Caucasian. Does she not count? That seems so wrong to me.
Well, we see that a lot with movie stars too. When Halle Berry accepted her Oscar, I mean, she quickly, you know, identified herself with that half of her family, even though she's half Caucasian as well. We see with Barack, you know, I mean, you can play the race card and get a lot farther in many industries and in politics than you can, you know, being Caucasian.
It is a bit like, look, it's just a You look at what happened in the Soviet Union. They claimed to be creating fairness by abolishing class and by abolishing capitalism and having everything allocated by the state. All that emerged was a different form of class system where you had, you know, the nomenklatura, the favored members, party members, awarded special privileges, their special Zill lanes for their cars to drive down, their special dacha in the country, you know, the special supplies of caviar and vodka and stuff, at the expense of the poor, hard-working, oppressed citizens. In the same way, when people exploit the system like that, when people use their skin color just to get to, you know, finesse the system in order to get special privileges, it is immoral. I think everyone should compete on fair terms. I don't believe that there should be special privileges purely because of the color of your skin. In fact, what happens when you do that is something even more unfair than the unfairness it supposedly replaces. For example, if you've got, you know, special treatment for racial minorities, special access to universities and so on, what inevitably happens is that say you're a really talented black kid or Latino kid or whatever, there will always be this sly assumption that you got where you are because you played the race card. You know, what if you got there on merit? It's wrong liberalism.
Oh, I you're not going to get any disagreement here. One of the things I read in the cover of the book is that you actually helped break the ClimateGate story. Talk to us about how that came about.
Well, yeah, I think the full credit should go to all those mainly American websites like What's Up With That and so on that sort of broke the story in the blogosphere. I'm lucky enough to have a blog in the Daily Telegraph newspaper, which has got a kind of biggish international audience. And I broke the story on my Telegraph blog, and it got picked up by Drudge, and it went viral. So that's where my credit begins, I suppose. And I was the second person to use the word ClimateGate. I noticed somebody else use it, so I guess I'm the guy who popularized ClimateGate and made the story big. Because, as you remember, the mainstream media did not do a very good job of broadcasting this story. In fact, one gets the distinct impression they tried to cover it up. Why did they try and cover it up? Well, ClimateGate was about these emails, which were leaked from the University of East Anglia, which is one of the world's main centers of climate change research, one of the main places where they all believe in man-made global warming. And what these leaked emails showed is that the scientists behind the Al Gore's, you know, man-made global warming agenda are a bunch of liars, I think is not an unfair way of putting it. You know, they have been exaggerating the evidence for man-made global warming, underplaying the evidence that shows that maybe there are other factors involved in global warming. Not that there is any global warming at the moment, by the way. I mean, there hasn't been any since 1998. We're on a cooling trend at the moment. And yet, crazily, we are spending billions, if not trillions of dollars every year trying to alleviate this problem, which isn't actually a problem. Now, that is crazy. And I'm very proud to have been part of the counter-revolution, which has helped expose their agenda, which ClimateGate was the start.
You know, I think it's interesting you made the point about the mainstream media downplaying the story. One of my favorite examples of the double standard is an author named Chris Mooney, who insists that there is a Republican war on science, who immediately penned an article in the wake of ClimateGate entitled, "Why ClimateGate Ain't Nothing." So we have so many people in the United States who have supported this theory, and they have so much invested in terms of their credibility.
Mooney, you say?
Chris Mooney. I'll give me a copy of that.
He sounds just my kind of guy. Well, no, actually, he sounds very much a New York Times kind of guy, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm. He sounds like a Repkin kind of guy. The thing about ClimateGate is one of the ways they try to downplay it is to say, well, this was just a handful of scientists, you know, and there are thousands, tens of thousands who support this theory, but they totally ignore the fact that this was one of four of the major databases in the world that are looked to.
Yeah. You're absolutely right, yeah. This so-called handful of scientists also happen to be the handful of scientists who are the lead authors on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, on their assessment reports. And these assessment reports, as I'm sure you know, are the ones that inform government policy around the world. You know, these guys are supposed to represent the gold standard of climate science. So if these guys start behaving like crooks, really, who can you trust?
Well, you take a look at some of the things that were in there. I think someone discovered a line of Fortran code that actually had a note beside it that said fudge factor. And I had Patrick Michaels on the show, and there's a email where one of the Al Gore Kool-Aid drinkers, says that he wants to beat the crap out of Patrick Michaels. I mean, just some of the stuff that's in there is amazing. And we brought up Repkin a few minutes ago. If I'm not mistaken, there is an email from Repkin to Michael Mann that Repkin says, oh, don't worry about Eminem out of Canada, you know, in their attack on the hockey stick graph. I'm going to cover that from a very oblique angle. Since when is it the job of the New York Times to lessen the impact of a story by covering it from an oblique angle? I mean, all this stuff is very troubling, and as my friend Joe Nova in Australia likes to say, these guys aren't just liars, they're climate bullies. You know, we talk about denying tenure to people who don't support the theory, about blackballing publications, peer-reviewed publications that don't support the theory or dare to allow a dissenting opinion in. I mean, this is pretty serious stuff from an academic standpoint.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here, dude. Yeah, absolutely. The reason I wrote 365 ways to drive a liberal crazy, and the reason that I've become one of the go-to guys for, I suppose, what you would call climate change skepticism, is part of the same thing, which is that you know, the international green movement and socialism, liberalism are intimately bound up. And this isn't to say that there aren't people on the left who are skeptical about climate change, but actually when you look at the agenda of the Green Movement, it is basically the same agenda as held by liberals everywhere, which is to say, liberals believe, their core belief, I think, is that government's job is there to regulate human behavior and to sort out the problems of the world. And I take the exact opposite view, that government's job is to do the bidding of the people, that government is our servant, not our master. And Thomas Jefferson fully recognized this when in the early days. So, you know, the founding fathers had it absolutely right. They recognized that unregulated government leads to tyranny. And we're now in this awful universe where I think it happened as a result of the two world wars. I think people got used to the idea that there were some problems so big in the world that only big government could sort them out, you know, the war being the obvious one. But now these new bugbears have arisen, which also apparently require big government intervention. And what could be more pressing, or at least if you believe the green socialists, than the idea that the world is about to come to an end thanks to man's greed and man's industry and man's economic growth, therefore you need the agencies of big government to step in to regulate all this to stop the world dying?
Well, yeah, if that were an actual problem, maybe there would be an argument that the governments of the world should step in. But, you know, man-made global warming is only man-made in the sense that men invented it, and it doesn't really actually
exist. Exactly. You know, in the same way, if an alien space fleet started gathering above Earth, or, and, you know, we spotted it through our telescopes, you know, I would not object to my tax dollar going towards building the giant death rays all over America and in Europe to try and forestall this alien invasion. But since the alien spaceships haven't actually arrived yet, I don't like the idea that we should be building these ray guns on the precautionary principle, on the just in case. You know, yes, just trust us. Spend all this millions of dollars on these death rays, because you never know, the aliens might appear. Well, you know, if that sounds crazy, it's no more crazy than the idea that we've got to bomb our Western economy, bomb our economy into the dark ages, on the vague possibility that some scientists think it might be that CO2 emissions are causing the planet to heat up. It looks more and more ridiculous every year. I mean, every cold winter we have, you know, we've had three extreme winters in a row in Britain. I think we've had some pretty freaky ice storm stuff in America too. This does not strike me as a sign that dangerous global warming is happening and that we should spend lots of money dealing with it.
James, you just haven't paid attention to the liberals. They have come out and explained that increased heat means increased evaporation, which means more moisture from which you can make snow and ice. So
yeah.
even though Al Gore in his movie An Inconvenient Truth said that global warming was the reason that the snows of Kilimanjaro were disappearing, now we understand that global warming leads to more snow, not less snow, like Al Gore told us all those years ago. And by the way, you really need to get with the times. It's not global warming anymore, James. It's climate change.
I think you're not with the times. Actually, it is now apparently called climate chaos.
Climate disruption. Climate what? I'm sorry.
Yes. It's whatever phrase du jour suits them, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, I think climate disruption was the last one I heard. But
that's right.
Go ahead.
No, I think, you know, when you reach a stage where snowfall can be used as a sign of extreme global warming, you know these guys have lost the plot completely.
Well, I'm borrowing from a site actually out of the UK, I put together a list of things caused by global warming, and I don't have access to it at this moment, but it's really kind of hilarious when you compare what's being said in different parts of the world. I mean, it's responsible for bigger fish, smaller fish, more snow, less snow, more prostitutes, less prostitutes, the death of the Loch Ness monster. I mean, you name it, and there are all these contradictions in terms of you know, what global warming is supposed to be causing. And some of these I got from the UK site, some of them I found myself on the internet. But, you know, if simple bloggers can put all this together and see how foolish it looks, the mainstream media certainly has the resources to do this, but they choose not to.
They choose not to, and it is definitely a choice that they have made. Look, one of the great things about, you know, the fact that you can do a radio show like you are, that I can blog my opinions on the internet, is that we have bypassed the traditional forms of authority that have been able to have been serving the liberal agenda for a long time. And again, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist here, but you know, you look at the mainstream media, you look at CNBC, you look at the New York Times, look at the BBC in Europe. They are all pushing the same liberal values, and they are not reporting the kind of stories that undermine their agenda. So here we are. At the moment, we've got pretty much unfettered freedom of speech. How long that lasts, I don't know. But we can say stuff like this. Yeah, I mean, when I've been promoting my, you know, 365 ways to drive a liberal crazy, I have not been doing interviews with the New York Times. I have not been on CNBC. It's been the talk radio, which is the only place that people like me have a voice. Long may it continue. And yet, you know, already liberals are talking about bringing back the fairness doctrine, you know, the idea that for every right-wing talk radio station, there should be another libtard one. Well, The reason there are so few libtard talk radio stations is because libtards are actually kind of dull. They've got nothing interesting to say. I mean, you know, they can make the odd sort of smugly consensual joke about the world. You know, I'm not saying they don't produce the odd good comedian, but actually when it talks about the issues of the day, they can't address them honestly. Going back to that reason I mentioned earlier, that liberals do not address the world as it is. They address it as it ought to be. The liberal mentality is a great fiction, and the biggest fiction of all is the idea that the government, that people you don't know in authority over you are capable of knowing better than you do how to live your life, how to spend your money. How crazy is that? It is, to me, that is immoral. To me, taxation is a form of theft. And it was in that spirit of frustration and despair that I wrote 365 Ways to Drive a Liberal Crazy. You know, there are some bad taste jokes in it. There are some quotes from great men in history. There are some facts. I think, you know, we conservatives need weapons to use against the enemy.
We do, and I think it's time we started fighting back. That's why I'm so excited about the Tea Party movement. You know, I can recall before the Tea Party hit, I was discussing, well, I think it was Ashley Judd, and Ashley Judd is famous for being all in favor of partial birth abortions, but thinking that Sarah Palin is cruel for allowing wolves to be hunted from airplanes in Alaska. And I had this conservative across the table from me, and she was saying, yes, Ashley Judd is horrible, I can't stand her, blah, 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 blah. This was back during the 2008 election. And I said, so if an Ashley Judd movie came to town and I wanted to get some conservatives together to carry signs and protest outside the theater, would you join me? And she said, oh, my, no, that's not dignified. Republicans don't act that way. That's what Democrats do. And that's part of the problem. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think she's absolutely right. You know, I get so much hate mail for my views. I get, you know, there are people out there who really loathe me and want to destroy me. I don't get the urge to do to liberals, you know, to hound them personally. It just seems to me a warped thing to want to do. I would never send hate mail to a liberal. I mean, I write books to annoy them, but to make it all personal, I think is just, well, I mean, bordering on the psychopathic.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. I originally blogged under a pen name, and someone whose name I won't even mention on this show, but someone who's considered the grandfather of the mainframe computer here in the United States, decided to use his computer skills to research my real name and went as far as to go onto a very liberal, warmest Al Gore-supporting site and post my real name and, you know, what town I lived in and the exact location of my home relative to a nearby university. And then I went on the site classmates.com and found that he had been visiting my classmates page, and I felt like I was being somewhat stalked. And
you were being stalked. Isn't that so sinister? I had something similar. I had something called the British Antarctic Survey, and they are, for some reason, fiercely warmist. They're great believers in man-made global warming. And one of their guys brought up a website with a name similar to mine, except, you know, his version ended .co.uk rather than .com, and just used it to link to a site which was, you know, to do with the exact opposite of what I believe in. Now, you know, you could say that's a good bit of, you know, guerrilla warfare, that you know, all is fair in love and war and stuff. But there seems to me something a little warped about the kind of mentality which rather than engage with my arguments, instead seeks to destroy me or ridicule me through kind of black ops.
I agree with you. I think one of the best examples of that might be, there was a gentleman in Tennessee who got a hold of Al Gore's home electric bill, which was public information. He published it, and, I mean, you know what a hypocrite Al Gore is when it comes to his own electrical usage. And so the man received 6 death threats for publishing Al Gore's home electric bill. Now, you would think if these warmest... Yes, and you would think that these warmest would look at that, and instead of going after the man who published the truth, the messenger, they would go to Al Gore and say, Al, you're our leader, yet you have a large houseboat. Your home consumes 10 times the electricity that the average home consumes. What's wrong with you? Why aren't you leading by example? But no, they went to the man who published the electric bill, and they threatened his life. That's the way these people operate.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I think we conservatives, and well, I mean, certainly where I'm coming from, I'm a libertarian conservative, I suppose a Tea Party, a South Park conservative even. Where we're coming from is that we operate on the principles of live and let live. I mean, it doesn't mean to say you can't go hunting and stuff, but the point is that we don't condemn the behavior of others in the way that liberals do. You know, liberals make out that conservatives sit in judgment all the time and you know, want to make these rules. But it seems to me that most of the rulemaking and bossing around is being done by liberals.
Yes, Fela McAleer from Ireland was someone I interviewed for a print article, and he said that when he originally was coming to America, he had been warned by liberals that there were all these conservatives in America who were going to be quite interested in what he did in his bedroom, but he said when he got here, he found instead there were all these liberals who were more interested in what kind of light bulbs he used. But
yeah.
I think that sums it up, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm feeling. Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, please. Yeah, no, I was going to say, I've lost my train of thought. You prompted me.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that there were some bad taste jokes in your book, and I'm going to go ahead and address those because, you know, let me see if I've got these here. You make a reference to libtards, and that runs the risk of offending anyone with a special needs person in their family. You talked about crazy-eyed Japanese militarism, which sort of conjures up images of John Wayne in the movie The Fighting Seabees, referring to Tojo's bug-eyed monkeys. And then you talk about Al Gore saying that a zebra can't change his spots, which, James, you may think you're clever, but that was, in fact, was it not a thinly veiled reference to Barack Obama's mixed race?
I believe it, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. But I mean, you basically take shots at everyone in here. You took no prisoners. Do you worry that some of the things you put in this book are so offensive that they might offend conservatives? I mean, there are conservatives with special needs children. There are conservatives who are Japanese. There are conservatives, you know, who might think that you've crossed the line here.
Yeah, and it's certainly true that I think Americans are a lot more can be a lot more sensitive than the sort of brash, gung-ho types that you know, we caricature you in Europe as being, you know, vulgar, insensitive, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's not been my experience in America. I find that you're often very polite, good-mannered. You don't cuss as much as we do in Europe. We swear an awful lot in England. I certainly do.
Well, I went to Catholic school, so I might be an exception to that.
Right. Well, yeah, of course it worries me that I'm going to offend the people I want to buy my book, i.e. the conservative half of America. And of course, you've got parts of America, particularly the Midwest, you know, where conservatives are very religious, very squeamish about some of the sort of the libertarian principles that I believe in. I like to think that I'm an equal opportunity offender. I like to think that I don't pick on any particular group. I like to think that I can be, you know, be politically incorrect about disability, about race, about religion, about anything. I think this is one of the the great freedoms that we have won, the people have fought for, and I don't want to sacrifice that freedom in order to appease a mentality which I think is essentially a liberal mentality of political correctness. I think that this is a dangerous construct. In fact, I would say that on a serious note, humor is one of the ways we use to deal with uncomfortable issues. It's the way we negotiate taboos in society. And, you know, for example, there's a joke in the book about Barack Obama, where I say, why was he disappointed by men who stare at goats? And he goes something like, because he was a Muslim, he thought it would be a love story. Well, of course, you know, that is outrageously offensive. It implies that Muslims like sleeping with goats, which I don't believe at all. I think, you know, I know a lot of Muslims, and I think, you know, they're nice people. You know, I think they've got a perfectly okay religion. I don't want to make their lives miserable. At the same time, there is definitely a threat in the world from political Islam, from Islamofascism, whatever you want to call it. There are doubts about Barack Obama's loyalties, his religious sympathies, particularly in the way that he seems to have sort of surrendered American interests, in his infamous Cairo speech and so on. And also people like to laugh at a good tasteless joke. So these all seem to me eminently good reasons why one should be able to free to make these jokes. I don't think that humor should be off limits.
I actually agree with you, but I wanted to get that out there because there were just a few in there that I thought, wow, he's really, at least from my perspective, I felt like you had kind of at least approached the line, if not crossed it. So, and you know, you've got these freedoms, and at least until the Fairness Doctrine comes out, and then you'll have to censor yourself in America. But which is a translation for nobody wants to listen to a liberal talk show host, so we'll have to force the issue. You make a good point. I mean, they've got the mainstream media. They've got television. They've got the newspapers. They've got CNBC. They've got MSNBC. They've basically got the universities. They've got the courts. I mean, they have everything except talk radio, and now they want that too.
Yeah, exactly. Look, to go back to the original point, because liberalism involves a deeply tortured, wrong-headed view of the world, you know, one that it is warped and illogical, the only way that they can maintain what I suppose you might call the liberal hegemony, the liberal control of the world, is through underhand means, I get, you know, only by controlling the media. All the media, only by government making new rules which constrict various kinds of freedom, can they maintain their power. And this is why it's so great that we have the internet and talk radio, to be able to undermine those pillars of authority.
Well, now, we mentioned the mainstream media, and one of the things that's bothered me, it's bothered me for a long time, but especially during the 2008 election, is the portrayal of Sarah Palin as being stupid. And you can go back, you know, farther in time, and Dan Quayle being stupid, George W. Bush, or as we like to call him here in Texas, W, not being smart enough.
What about Ronald Reagan? I mean, at school. I think I was the only guy in my school, and we're talking about a private school in England in the 1980s, early 80s, late 70s. I was the only guy in the school who didn't think that Reagan was a dumb cowboy. Why did people think Reagan was a dumb cowboy? Because at every opportunity, the liberal media would tell you that he was a dumb cowboy. You know, you listen to the one-liners the guy came up with. He was an absolute genius. And yet, even when he was rescuing the American economy and essentially destroying, even when he was winning the Cold War, even for all this, all that he achieved, as far as the liberal narrative went, he was a dumb cowboy. And in the same way over here in Britain, Margaret Thatcher, the woman who destroyed the power of the trade unions, which was ruining the British economy. You know, we were sclerotic. We were yesterday's country. We were going nowhere. Margaret Thatcher rescued us from becoming the new Albania. And yet, how is she recognized now? She is recognized as this kind of shrill personification of greed. Of, you know, she was the woman who pushed it too far. I mean, there's a certain amount of sexism in the portrayal of Margaret Thatcher, which is weird coming from liberals who are supposed to be against sexism. They will throw anything they've got at these people because they don't want us to realise just how good they were in espousing conservative values and how effective conservative values are at making the world better.
You know, not only does the mainstream media take smart conservatives and make them look dumb, portray them as being stupid, but they also tend to build up liberals who don't deserve to be there. I'm going to ask you to tolerate me for a moment while I include a couple things from your book and add a few things I found myself about Barack Obama and things that the mainstream media have ignored. This is a guy, as you pointed out, who said that he had been to 57 states. He said corpsman instead of corpsman. He thought American was a language. At least he said so when he was in France. He tried to say the 4th of May, and he said 4 de cinco, which means 4 of 5. I'll point out that Bush got that right when he entertained Mexican dignitaries. He says Alzheimer's instead of Alzheimer's. He said that after Khrushchev put the missiles in Cuba, that essentially Kennedy met with Khrushchev and got those missiles out of Cuba, when in fact they met first and Khrushchev put the missiles there after JFK had met with him. Barack Obama has said America invented the automobile, which I'm sure, you know, the Germans were interested in. He said that the health care bill would cause an over 3,000% drop in the price of the healthcare premiums for employers, not realizing that anything above 100% drop in price would mean that the government would have to pay people to take it. He was addressing a group of military veterans, and he said, on this day that we honor our fallen heroes, and I see many of you in the audience today, so apparently you can see dead people. And he also claimed that the reason his parents, you know, even though they were a different race, were able to get together and have Barack Obama Jr. was because some people marched across a bridge in Selma, Alabama. The only problem being the march across the bridge took place 4 years after Barack Obama was born. So whether it comes to vocabulary, foreign language, mathematics, history, this guy makes gaffe after gaffe after gaffe that would indicate that he didn't pay attention very well in school, yet he is hailed by the liberal media as being the smartest president America has ever had. James, what do you make of all this?
Well, it's all spin, isn't it? I think if you're going to criticize Bush for his, what's the word he used, where he gets his words jumbled up.
I think
yeah, exactly. And if you're going to criticize Ronald Reagan for the occasional gaffe and you're going to have a go at Sarah Palin, then clearly you've got to be open about Obama's, you know, gaffes as well. But ultimately, you know, these are just tiny details. You know, the fact that liberals feel these things are worth focusing on just shows the kind of bankruptcy of their philosophy, because the real issue, surely, is what good or bad these people achieve as leaders. Of course, if you're going around the world talking every day, of course you're going to say the occasional dumb thing or make the occasional mistake. You know, I mean, I've been doing days and days of talk radio. I wouldn't want to stand by every single word I said. You know, sometimes I've accidentally said the opposite of what I mean, but you know, I try to keep on the straight and narrow and try and speak the truth as best I understand it. But you know, to focus on the trivia of what Sarah Palin says and not focus instead on what she really stands for, which is, I think, you know, first principles, small government, low taxes. Would I feel comfortable having Sarah Palin in the White House? I suspect that she probably isn't the sharpest tool in the box. I suspect that, you know, there are probably better candidates for the White House. But I think even Sarah Palin understands that. You know, I see her as a kingmaker, and as the kind of dynamic force which is going to point America in the right direction. And I say fair play to her. Go, girl.
You know, there's a lot that's said about the N-word. And one of the things that has crossed my mind is that liberals are given a free pass when it comes to making racial remarks. I mean, we had Joe Biden say that Barack Obama was America's first clean, good-looking, articulate black man. We had Harry Reid quoted in a book as saying that Barack Obama doesn't have to have an African-American accent unless he wants one. You know, Jesse Jackson made the Hymietown remark. And, you know, you can look at the liberal journalist. Dan Rather was on Chris Matthews' show on MSNBC and actually said that Barack Obama was not a very good salesperson in terms of selling his policies. In fact, he said Barack Obama couldn't sell watermelons on the side of the road if he had the state troopers flagging down the traffic for him, which is, I guess, somewhat appropriate because, you know, Dan Rather used to work with Mike Wallace at 60 Minutes. And back in, I think it was 1984 when I was still in college, Mike Wallace was caught on tape while, I guess they were changing out film or something, but he was caught on audio tape when talking to a banker about all the minorities that had lost their homes due to taking out these home improvement loans. Mike Wallace was trying to make the point that essentially these contracts were hard for people to understand if they were minorities. And he said, yeah, but, you know, he said they're a little complicated whenever you're discussing them over the watermelon or over the tacos. So we have liberal journalists right off of 60 Minutes, Mike Wallace, Dan Rather, making watermelon remarks. You know, Joe Biden talking about Obama being the first clean, articulate, good-looking black man. I mean, it seems to me that if you're a liberal, you can make the most insensitive, racially offensive remarks that you want with complete impunity.
Yes, and it is indeed one of the attractions of liberalism, that, you know, it's why so many rich people who really ought to be natural conservatives are liberal. It's a kind of spray on righteousness. It requires no effort. You know, when you say that you're a liberal, job done. You know, you are a caring person. You have good taste in music. You are better in bed. You care about the poor and the oppressed and about little furry animals with pink eyes and little smiley mouths. And you want to heal the world. You want to save the world. You care about the environment. All this just by saying you're a liberal. If you are a conservative, you are constantly going out into the world having to defend yourself. You are constantly being forced to justify your position. The upside of this is that conservatives generally are better in debate, better in debating the facts, certainly, because they have the facts at their fingertips and the facts of life, as Margaret Thatcher said, are conservative. The downside is that it means that you are in a constant state of war, in a way that liberals aren't. I mean, you know, if you're a liberal among liberals, it's fine. You know, everyone knows you're a nice guy. Everyone knows you care. If you're a conservative among liberals, you know, you're the bad guy. And it's something one has to get used to. Tarsome though it is.
Well, you mentioned that conservatives tend to have the facts at their fingertips, or that Margaret Thatcher had said that. One of the things I've noticed is that liberals don't have to have any facts because they have a secret weapon known as the F word. Jennifer Aniston, when asked about George W. Bush, said F Bush. During the 2008 campaign, Madonna and her former girlfriend, Sandra Bernhard, both used the F word in reference to Sarah Palin. Biden, you know, pointed out that the health care bill was a big effing deal. We've got Jesse Jackson saying he wanted to cut Obama's testicles off. And most liberals I know are really vulgar. And if you have an argument with one and you lay out the facts, for instance, if you're arguing about whether the economy was Bush's fault and you're trying to talk about the Community Reinvestment Act, you know, they'll just say F you, and then with a smug look on their face, walk off and think that they won because they said F you. I mean, what is it with liberals being so vulgar, James? I mean, can you help us understand that?
Well, you know, I like to think of liberalism as a form of arrested development. It's sort of, you know, it's the kind of adolescent teenage state where, you know, when you're a teenager, you think that life is unfair. You know, that that your parents are wrong about everything. They just didn't know stuff. That they don't feel stuff in the same way you do. You know, you feel really strongly about the world. You have a gift which allows you to see the world as it really is, and what you see is darkness and injustice and unfairness. And you also think, by the way, that your parents should give you more money. Why? Just because they should, because they don't know how much you suffer, and it's kind of unfair that they've got money and you haven't. And yet you want to spend your time hanging around smoking dope and listening to loud music and stuff, and that's your right because you're young and you're angry and you're free. Well, most of us grow out of this stage. Liberals don't. It is a mental condition, and there can be no meeting of minds. You know, when my eldest kid was a teenager, you know, I'd tell him stuff, I'd tell him facts, I'd tell him about how the world works. You know, like you've got to work and stuff, and that's how you pay off your mortgage, that's how you educate your kids. He wasn't buying it. Now he's grown up, you know, we had a talk about it the other day. He said to me, you know, he suddenly understood what I'd been saying all along. And, yeah, right, I'm glad he did. But if he was a liberal, he'd never have gone through that. He'd never have reached that enlightenment.
I hear you. I have a brother that has been a liberal most of his life. He's slightly becoming more conservative, but for the vast majority of his life, everything he did wrong, every little problem he had was either the fault of our parents or the fault of the Catholic Church. It was always someone else's fault instead of his. And, you know, I frankly have an uncle that way who constantly gripes that, you know, his parents haven't given him enough money. So it's just amazing to me that they, you know, that may be why they want a cradle-to-grave nanny state. I mean, these are people who feel like, you know, everyone should be taking care of them and, you know, they should just be able to, you know, go through museums and look at work put out by the National Endowment for the Arts or something, which I seem to recall you referencing the NEA in your book as well.
Referencing the what, sorry? The
National Endowment for the Arts, the NEA?
Oh, yes, what you mean, Mike. Oh, I don't want to repeat that one. That's naughty. But, yeah, you know, right. I mean, I was exposing, again, a degree of liberal hypocrisy that Andres Serrano artwork, Piss Christ, was funded by the NEA. Can you really imagine that if somebody approached them with something sort of besmirching the name of the Prophet Muhammad? Can you imagine the NEA giving money to that? I think not. There is a great deal of liberal hypocrisy.
Well, it's amazing that even liberals like Bill Maher, who will constantly say that he's an atheist and anyone who believes in God is stupid, is really, I mean, aiming that at conservatives who are Christians. I mean, I've yet to hear him say anything negative about Muslims. He's constantly, you know, pointing out that he's in favor of the mosque being built at Ground Zero. And, you know, it's interesting that all these liberals who are, you know, atheist or agnostic and have little respect for Christian religion and claim they have no respect for religion at all are very, very quick to defend the Muslim faith. And I'm not sure I understand that as well.
No. What's that?
Let me throw another thing at you and see if I made an observation, and I want to see if you've made the same one, because as I read your book, I kept thinking, you know, I think a lot like this guy, or this guy thinks a lot like me. One of the things I've noticed is that liberals think that since conservatives are so big on national security, all they have to do is to say an issue is about national security, and suddenly conservatives are going to support it. And for one example, the military in the United States has come out and said that global warming poses a threat to national security. Then Michelle Obama came out and said that fat kids in America pose a threat to national security, because if we needed to, you know, muster up some number of troops, one out of four fat kids is too fat to go through the basic training. And then Joe Biden, when they were trying to get that $1 trillion-plus omnibus spending bill through, suggested that getting that bill through was a matter of national security because, you know, everything was going to shut down if that bill didn't go through. Of course, that was a lie.
Yeah.
non-essential personnel get let go. But it seems to me that liberals have this new tactic that if they want to try to pass a bill, they just say, hey, it's about national security. You guys should be for this.
Well, of course, they're trying to employ the language of conservatism. They think that the one thing that's going to play well with red status is national security. So they come over storming Norman in order to make out that they actually give a damn about America. I think they'd probably be more than happy if America was invaded by the entire third world and taken over, because then the evil oppressive WASP hegemony would be destroyed forever, which I think ultimately is what they want. Certainly what people like Michael Moore want. They feel embarrassed to be white and Protestant. They think that this is you write a book called Stupid White Men. Michael Moore did a stand up show in England, and I don't know whether he did it in America as well. But Moore's thesis on 9/11 was that if those planes had been full of black guys instead of white people, they wouldn't have taken any shit from the terrorists. No siree. They'd have used their black pride and they'd have stormed those cabins straight away. Well, that it's wrong and untrue on so many levels that I'm astonished he had the gall to say it. For a start, there were black people on those flights, just as whether there were white people on those flights, and probably Muslim people on those flights as well, who were innocent passengers. And secondly, a lot of the planes they didn't even have the chance to know what was going on until it was too late. It's just extraordinary, this doing down of a culture and a civilization which has brought more good to the world than any civilization in history. We are the sum of the wisdom of the ancients, of the Greeks and the Romans, the sum of Judeo-Christian values, of the values of the Enlightenment, and we have melded all these things together to form the least awful form of governance and of a political system that has probably ever been in history. And the idea now that there are people within our culture, and they are all liberals, who look across to other cultures, to show us the way out of our misery and unhappiness, it's just crazy. Why do they? What is it that they hate about our civilization so much? What is it they hate about all this? Do they object to penicillin? Do they object to the invention of air travel? Do they object? What is their problem with progress?
That's an excellent question, and Michael Moore is the king of the hypocrites. Anyway, Peter Schweitzer wrote a book called "Do As I Say, Not As I Do: Profiles in Liberal Hypocrisy," and for all of Michael Moore's whining on about what Caucasians haven't done for African Americans, the truth of the fact is he hires practically no African Americans to work on his films. And you would think a guy that was this gung-ho about racial equality would be a leader to the rest of us by employing a fair number of African-Americans on his films, but he employs practically none. So Michael Moore is also famous for saying he didn't own a single penny of stock, and it turned out to be a complete lie. So, when you see people like this, it's hard to know what to make of them. And as far as why they hate America and why they hate white people so much, I don't know. I absolutely can't figure it out unless they feel somehow guilty about the success that they've had. I brought up Peter Schweitzer. One of the things that he points out in yet another one of his books, I believe it's called The Makers and the Takers. I could be wrong, but I think that's it. He points out that liberals aren't very generous with their own money, and you make the same reference in your book. Talk to us about that.
Yes, where is it? The other one I was thinking of is the one where they're not so generous with their blood. Apparently, if Democrats gave blood in the same quantities that conservatives do, America would have 45% more blood. So, you could argue that liberals are a drain and conservatives are the lifeblood of America. Literally.
I've never thought of it that way. Now, you seem like me to be someone who's just fed up, completely fed up with the global warming thing. I was unaware that in addition to inventing the internet and global warming, that Al Gore is also an astronaut.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. One of his many claims. I think that, yeah. I think one about half the book's entries out of 365 are Al Gore quotations. And the other half are Joe Biden quotations. You know, I just found one at random. Quote Joe Biden on choosing a president. I believe that's a metaphor for what the country is looking for. They're looking for a sleepover with people they like. Mm. He's a lunatic.
Well, I mean, Joe Biden has done so many great things. In addition to the racial quote that we put out earlier, he also is famous for saying that the economy boils down to a three-letter word, jobs, and then he spelled it out, J-O-B-S. He's a guy.
Yeah, yeah, and all that, yeah.
He made a reference to racial epitaphs. I think he meant racial epithets, but with Joe, you're never sure. He invited people to visit him in Delaware at his favorite restaurant, Katie's Restaurant. It had been closed since the mid-80s. I mean, this guy really isn't playing with a full deck. I'm sorry.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. No.
Then again, when you hear Chu talk about painting the world white in order to reflect the sun.
That's right. Yes, of course. Yeah. Your energies are, yeah.
Biden apparently not the only one in the Obama administration.
No. Well, I mean, it's a collective of kooks, the Obama administration. You know, look at John Holdren, look at what he believes. You know, the science czar. You know, he believes in eugenics. And the Green Movement, of course, sprang out of the eugenics movement and indeed before that, Nazism. You know, they're part and parcel of the same controlling phenomenon.
Yeah, I think we have Cass Sunstein, who believes that animals should be allowed to sue people?
Well, that's one of my favorite bits of the book. And can I make this my closing bit? Because I'm really losing it now. But I get sugar rushes. I don't think you quite got it. I flip if I don't eat some food. My favorite book in the book is where I invent lies that ought to be true about liberals. You know, for example, there's one about that Senator Harry Reid has 666 on his on his left testicle, and this was the inspiration for The Omen. And I was just trying to find the
that's actually true.
And Cass, where is the Cass Sunstein wrong? Yeah, I say that he has a kind of a whole menagerie of animals in his house, and that he conducts special animal trials of humans. He invites his friends around for animal trials, and I quite like the idea of true lies about liberals.
True lie. Well, it's funny because there was so much talk about John McCain not doing a good enough job of vetting Sarah Palin, and now we've got this White House full of kooks, a guy who thinks that animals should be allowed to sue people, a school czar who told children when he was a high school counselor that it's okay for sex to take place between children and adults. You know, we see the weatherization czarina, Catherine Tsui, talking about SWAT teams invading neighborhoods and retroactively fitting the houses with energy-efficient windows and appliances and so forth. I mean, this really is a special group of people. I can't imagine that any vetting took place whatsoever.
No, exactly. I just found another of my starter rumor ones. I'll read you this rumor that I think should be spread. Arnold Schwarzenegger is now the world's 14th richest man. He made his fortune by short-selling shares in Californian industries shortly before introducing his sweeping program of job-destroying, green bureaucrat-boosting eco-legislation. I mean, it is terrible what's being done to America in the name of the environment. How could the world's fifth largest, there's that old saying that if California seceded, it would be the world's fifth largest economy. How can, in the space of what, 20 years, how can a thriving economy like that be destroyed by eco-nut cases? It beggars belief. I say beware, America, beware of what you're about to lose if you're not careful.
Well, the problem is that nobody calls these people on anything. And in Arnold Schwarzenegger's case, and I was actually a big fan of his when I was younger, Arnold Schwarzenegger
He was good in Predator.
I think we're about the same age, and I go back farther than that. I go back to
Conan.
Pumping Iron. No, way before Pumping Iron. And that actually inspired me to get into bodybuilding and weightlifting for a while. And before Pumping Iron, there was a little-known film called Hercules in New York, where they had to dub in another voice because no one could understand him. But the thing about Arnold that I found impressive is that he was encouraging citizens of California to not use an electric dryer in their home to dry clothes, but instead to hang the clothes out on a clothing line, he was flying to and from work in a private jet. So,
doesn't that apply to a lot of, how big's Al Gore's carbon footprint? The hypocrisy is unbelievable. So I just hope that this book would do a little bit towards redressing the balance, taking revenge for all the misery that these guys are inflicting on us. But thank you for talking to me.
Absolutely.
You what?
I was going to say we are out of time, but I did want to encourage everyone who's listening to take a look at the webpage, scroll down to the bottom, and you will actually see both of your books, Welcome to Obamaland and 365 Ways to Drive a Liberal Crazy. All they need to do is click on them. They'll be transported to Amazon.com where they can purchase their own copies. And I just want to thank you for being here today. I've enjoyed the conversation, and we hope to have you back again sometime soon.
Thank you, Mark. That's very kind.
Have a great day.
Thanks, Mark. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.